Good afternoon, and thank you all parties for standing by. I would like to inform you that your conference call is going to be recorded today. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Thank you. Please begin the call.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Joe Bateski. I'm a member of the Cassini Science Planning Team, and I'm here to introduce the speakers for today's Charm Telecon. This is the first of a two-part anniversary telecon that's going to be held somewhat out of order because of the availability of the different speakers. Ideally, we would start with a mission overview, but that's going to be done actually at the next CHARM at the end of July. And we will also have talks at that time talking about icy satellites and Titan and also about rings. I'd like to remind people that if you have a phone and you feel a need to be typing or coughing or eating lunch, that *6 is going to mute your line, and if you need to toggle it back on to ask a question, which we certainly encourage people to do, press *6 again and that will unmute. So with that, I'd like to start with our first speaker, Dr. Andy Ingersoll, who is an imaging co-investigator on Cassini and a Saturn interdisciplinary scientist. And Dr. Ingersoll has asked that if people have questions, that they should feel free to interrupt him and ask for clarification. Go ahead.
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
yes, please interrupt and ask questions. And let's all go to slide one, which explains something about this talk. As you can imagine, NASA does care about that we're doing our job and doing it in a rational way with objectives, and we're meeting the objectives and being realistic about them. And so I prepared this talk in February for a senior review, which means senior scientists were reviewing the project. And I did my part, which was to talk about the planet Saturn, and there were other scientists who talked about the rings and the icy satellites and so on. So I'm going to give that same talk, and I'm hoping that some of the excitement of Cassini will come through, but also you'll get a feel for how we organize ourselves by setting objectives and trying to meet them. So the second slide shows our objectives for the extended mission. That's what XXM stands for. And they're really organized into two groups, the blue group and the red group. And SC stands for seasonal change, because obviously if you spent 5 years in orbit around a planet, you've discovered a lot of things about that planet and made lots of observations, and you've learned something. And why should you extend that mission over longer times? Well, if the planet has any weather, you like to see how the weather changes with seasons. That's also true of the moon Titan, which has weather of its own, and we're quite interested in the weather on both planets. But everything about the Saturn system is changing. Remember, Saturn's year is very long. It's 30 Earth years, and this year, 2009, we're switching from sun in the southern hemisphere to sunlight in the northern hemisphere of Saturn, so it's equinox. And we want to continue on into the northern summer solstice in 2017 to really complete at least half a year of observation. So seasonal change is broken down into three different categories, 1A, 1B, and 2A. There's sort of a prioritized listing, which means that when you run out of resources, human or spacecraft resources, go for the higher priority objective. And the other is, I can't remember what S stands for, but N stands for new. These are objectives which we didn't anticipate when we went into the prime mission, and things have come up and we want to pursue them. There are unanswered questions that arose during the prime mission, and so the first main objective for the extended mission, extended XXM, is the seasonal change, and the second is to pursue new things, new discoveries. So let's just sort of organize from the inside of the planet out, and so let's go to the third slide, and this is one of the unexpected new things. It's kind of a negative thing. We were not able to measure the rotation rate of Saturn. We thought we had it nailed from Voyager days, but it turns out we didn't. With Earth, we have continents, we have a solid planet. It's pretty easy to measure the day. The length of the day is a very fundamental measurement. With a fluid planet that has no solid surfaces, like Saturn, how are you going to define the rotation of the planet? You have all these features in the atmosphere, clouds and storms and things, and they are going around. You can watch them go around from outside the planet, and you can measure their rates, but some of them, at some latitudes, you have a jet stream that speeds up the rotation of features at that latitude, and other places you have a jet stream going the opposite way, and that slows the rotation down. And so you have a variety of rotation rates, ranging from 10 hours and 40 minutes to 10 hours and 10 minutes, if all you had was the atmospheric features. And we want something that tells us about the interior of the planet, and the usual way is the magnetic field, because that's generated down deep in the interior. And with Jupiter and Uranus and Neptune, the magnetic field is tilted, and so every day this wobbling top with its tilted magnetic field gives us a periodic wobble in the magnetic phenomena, any phenomenon that's associated with the magnetic field, and that period is the day. That's what we define to be the rotation of the interior of the planet. Well, Saturn's magnetic field is not tilted, so it just spins on the same, with the magnetic field lined up with the rotation axis, and so we have no handle to grab onto and measure the rotation rate of the interior. And this slide, number three, just shows you the three components of the magnetic field as Cassini made its closest approach on the very first orbit. And the degree of symmetry between before the closest approach at zero and after, that degree of symmetry says that the magnetic field is not tilted. And we don't know the rotation of Saturn's interior. We thought we did because there were radio emissions coming from Saturn that seemed to be periodic, that were periodic at the time of Voyager. But the period has changed. It's changed so much that it's impossible that the interior of the planet has changed that much. And so we have now realized that those radio emissions had to do with the electrically charged particles outside the planet in the magnetosphere and weren't really telling us about the interior at all. So we're still at a loss there. And so how are we going to get a better measurement of the magnetic field and its rotation? Well, go to the next slide. Get very close to the planet is one way, and make repeated close passes of the planet, hope that there'll be some irregularities and some small degree of tilt that we'll be able to measure when we're very close to the planet. So this sort of funny-looking Christmas tree ornament is a planet with many trajectories of the spacecraft making close passes many times to the planet. Another spacecraft that's going back to Jupiter, going to be launched in 2011, called Juno, is doing exactly this for Jupiter. And so Cassini plans to do this same kind of mapping of the magnetic field for Saturn, and we hope we'll get the rotation of the interior in that way. So that's one of our big objectives, is get the rotation of the interior. During these close passes, you not only measure the magnetic field and learn about the dynamo and the interior rotation, but you also measure the gravity field. And you can basically see how bulgy the planet is at the equator, and you can look for any lumps in the interior gravity of the planet and the mass distribution. And that's on the next slide. This shows little wedge-shaped cross-sections for each of the four giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And you can see at the tip there, at the very bottom, there's a rock core for each of the planets with an icy shell around it and then hydrogen above that. And we want to, among other things, we want to refine the mass of the core and the distribution of metallic hydrogen to ice. And for instance, we want to know how big the core is, because that affects our understanding of how the planet formed. There's sort of two schools of thought of how you form a giant planet. One is you form a rock ice core first, and then you, that has enough gravity to attract the hydrogen gas and helium gas. Or the other is you somehow form the whole ball of wax at once, and then the heavy elements settle out to the core later. So a better gravity field will help us learn these kinds of things. We also want to measure the helium to hydrogen ratio. This is the two most abundant elements in the universe, helium and hydrogen, and we don't fully know the relative abundance of helium and hydrogen on Saturn. That we can do by...
Sorry, Andy, a question. Do we not know them at all, or do we just not know them with... not to a very high degree of certainty?
The uncertainty is sort of a factor of two.
Oh.
helium could be anything from 5% to 10% by, I believe, mass. Although maybe it's counting molecules, I can't remember. And what happened was we have ways of doing it, which is to use one instrument called CIRS, C-I-R-S, to get the temperature, and then use another instrument, Radio Science, RSS, to get density, and density is really measuring temperature divided by molecular weight. So if you have one measurement of temperature and one of T over M, then you can get the molecular weight, and then with that you can get the helium. Well, that method was used for Jupiter and Saturn. It's Voyager data, and we had a nice number for Jupiter, and then along came the Galileo probe and said, whoops, your number is wrong, because the Galileo probe went in to the atmosphere and measured it more directly. So that upset our understanding of this method, upset our confidence in this particular method. So now all bets are off for Saturn because the method failed the test for Jupiter. And we have other methods, and we're going to try them out during extended missions. And I'm not going to go into the details of how those other methods work, but they all involve determining the hydrogen-helium ratio in the atmosphere and then assuming that that reflects the interior as well. All right, so let's go on. The next one is SC1B. And this figure on the right is the winds that were measured by various methods, mostly by tracking clouds in the atmosphere. And you'll notice at the bottom of this figure there's a zero. That zero is the you have to measure winds relative to something. When we measure winds on Earth, we are really measuring the winds relative to the solid Earth. And we don't have a solid planet. And so we get back to this problem of not knowing the rotation rate of Saturn. And these winds in this diagram are using this period we got from Voyager, which now we realize is changing all over the place and therefore isn't reliable. The solid curve is from Voyager. There's little speckles are a variety of measurements, some from Cassini and some from Hubble Space Telescope. And you can see that we and some curves are not on here even. We've made more measurements to look more like Voyager. But what we don't know is this where to put the zero of winds. And we need more measurements of the winds. We need a better measurement of the interior. And some of the variability you see in between the green points and the sort of yellowish points and red points may have to do with the winds varying in time, and some of it may have to do with the winds varying in altitude. You can see that the winds get up around 400 meters per second. And I gotta, for those of us who live in the United States and use miles per hour, that's about 10 times the speed of the jet streams on Earth. So when you're flying across the country, the U.S., from west to east, and your pilot says, well, we've got a favorable tailwind, she's probably in the jet stream and has picked up about a 40 meters per second. That's about a 100 mile per hour wind, which is zipping you along. Well, Saturn's winds are 10 times that. So that's a big deal. And it's even something of a mystery why, when you're so far from the sun, why should the winds be stronger than on Earth, which is much closer to the sun? And, well, you say, the winds don't have anything to rub against. These are gaseous planets. Maybe that helps the winds along. But then you compare Neptune, which is even farther from the sun, and the winds are stronger on Neptune than they are on Jupiter. And Saturn we don't know because we don't know where to put the zero. And it's all something of a mystery. Why should the winds not decrease when you move farther from the energy source? And seasonal change is important because we don't know whether the winds are changing with time or not, really.
I did have one question about this figure.
Yeah.
I was wondering why there is more of a mismatch between the different data sets at relatively small latitudes. As
near the equator, there's a bigger mismatch. Good question. We have not sorted it out. The answer?
Okay.
Although part of the reason we haven't sorted it out is that the equator is not a very cooperative place. You don't have clear features. All this is done by watching specific storms, little spots, and just watching them over periods of time. And if you don't have good features, if it's all bland fogginess, it's hard to measure the winds. And that's true of the equator, which is very bland there. Okay, in fact, this sort of shows that. The next slide, which is a black and white panel running across the page, this is, and it's labeled, thermal emission at 2 centimeters. Now, our eyes work at wavelengths less than a micron. That's 1/1,000,000th of a meter in wavelength. These are radio waves, 2 centimeters wavelength, so much, much longer wavelengths. What you're really seeing here is a map of one of the condensable gases in the atmosphere of Saturn, ammonia. And you can see the equator, which is in, sort of runs across the middle of this figure, is very different looking than the higher latitudes. And in the visible, it's also quite featureless. And so this is a very different sort of view of the planet, being able to look at ammonia gas, than the what you see with visible light, because in visible light you're really looking at clouds, and here we're looking at one of the gaseous constituents of the atmosphere. And all this helps us understand the circulation better to sort out these things. And of course,
Is there an analog for this on Earth? Something that is not a visible cloud that we have in our mind, but an example of a thing that responds to thermal emission, condensation?
Yes. You can go to the web or a weather site, and you can get satellite photos of that are sensitive to water vapor in the Earth's atmosphere. But water vapor. And they look like swirly artistic paintings of swirls and sort of a little bit like this. And of course, water vapor is a highly variable constituent in the Earth's atmosphere because it gets periodically rained out, and you have wet places and dry places. And ammonia is rather similar to that. It's sort of the equivalent gas on Saturn's upper atmosphere. And so it's highly variable. And so that's kind of what you're looking at here. Okay, now here's another slide. This one, if you look at the lower right, it says VIMS 5-micron imaging. Here, we're looking at a different wavelength. Again, we're looking at temperature, thermal emission. In other words, we're looking at infrared radiation or heat radiation coming out through the holes in the clouds. And this one sort of knocked our socks off because there's so much structure. We're looking deeper than the haze that you see in visible light. And apparently, when you look a little deeper into the atmosphere, 100 kilometers down below the tops of the clouds and haze, there's a tremendous amount of structure down there. There's a lot of meteorology going on. And
I'm disconnected somehow.
I can hear you. Don't sound disconnected to me. You can see how featureless the equator is. Look at the left hand of these two graphs. The equator is quite featureless at these deeper levels, but at higher latitudes, it's quite There's quite a lot of structure, more of it so than in visible light. Take another step, and this one is labeled SC1A and SC1V. This is a picture taken when the spacecraft was in the equatorial plane of Saturn, and the rings have disappeared from this image, except for that single dark line across the middle of the image, a straight line. So those are the rings, edge on, that straight line across the middle. And then the shadow of the rings in the northern hemisphere is the curvy dark band. And then above that, you can see a fairly detailed northern hemisphere, all the clouds very clearly enunciated in the northern hemisphere. Whereas down in the southern hemisphere, the clouds are there, but mostly they're obscured by this upper atmosphere haze. So that's a profound example of seasonal change. The northern hemisphere has been in darkness for almost 15 years, mostly shadowed by the rings. And as the ring shadow moves south with the seasons, the clear northern hemisphere comes into view. And the southern hemisphere has been in sunlight, and it's sort of been covered by haze. It's not too different from photochemical smog on Earth. You have methane, which is carbon and four hydrogens, and you can break apart the methane gas. Sunlight will break it apart, and you can form heavier hydrocarbons. It starts with acetylene and ethane, but it forms even heavier hydrocarbons, some of which condense, and you get little organic molecules and particles floating around in the atmosphere. And that apparently is what happens in the southern hemisphere. Let's move to the next slide. This is an early Cassini photo, and you can see how blue the sky is in the northern hemisphere and how sort of dusky pinkish it is in the sunlit southern hemisphere. This also has the ring. We're right in the plane of the rings, and the rings are almost invisible there. They're just that straight line across. All right, so we want to watch the seasons change and see how the smog dissipates when it's no longer in sunlight. Now, there's other strange things that we didn't anticipate. Next slide shows a hexagon in Saturn's northern hemisphere. Voyager saw a hexagon in Saturn's northern hemisphere, and of course, it's just a cloud. It's not any solid structure, and there was really no good reason to believe the hexagon would still be there 25 years later. Why should clouds last that long? And when the northern hemisphere started, when we started getting good views of the northern hemisphere, there it was, still six-sided and still in the same place. The center of the hexagon is the North Pole, and the latitude of the vertices of the hexagon is about 75 degrees north latitude, which means that the radius of the hexagon is bigger than the Earth. You could put six Earths into this picture inside the hexagon. What is it? Well, we don't fully know, but it's some kind of a wave pattern. There's a jet stream that at this latitude that instead of just going around counterclockwise, circling the planet at constant latitude. It seems to oscillate in and out, six times as it goes around, and that seems to be a stable configuration. And we're trying to collect a little more data on this jet stream and its meandering pattern. Is there anything special about six sides? I don't think so. I think if the wavelengths of these meanders were a little longer, you'd have a five-sided pattern. If it was a little shorter, you'd have seven sides. So I don't think there's any significance, except that six waves seems to fit nicely into this particular latitude. There are analogies to this, a jet-like structure that has permanent waves in the Gulf Stream on the Earth's ocean. It has permanent sort of wave-like patterns, and we're actively pursuing the similarities and differences between the Gulf Stream and this hexagon on Saturn. The next slide shows measurements that we've made. VIMS North shows the jet stream at 70, well, it looks more like 76, 77 degrees latitude. There's also a jet right up close to the equator at about 88 degrees latitude, and I'll say a little more about that in a second. Okay, moving on. There's a big reddish figure. This is the South Pole, and there's two sort of rings, very red in the center. One's labeled inner eye wall, and the other's labeled outer eye wall. And we have been looking at this thing. It has some similarities to a terrestrial hurricane. Next slide shows a oblique view of it in black and white, and it looks, if it looks sort of three-dimensional to you, it should, because the sun in this sort of oblique view is up to the upper right, and it's shining down at an oblique angle, and you could almost see the shadows on the inner eye wall, and those are indeed shadows. Remember, the diameter of this thing is, 2,000 kilometers across this inner wall. It's 2,000 kilometers. So it's huge, and to be able to see three-dimensional structure in something that's 2,000 kilometers across means that the height of these eye wall clouds, it gets up 60, 70 kilometers. That's higher. A terrestrial hurricane, the eye wall clouds get up to 15 kilometers. So this is the eye of a hurricane on steroids. It's much bigger diameter and much higher clouds. The next slide is nine little panels, each one with an arrow in it. The arrow shows the direction that the sunlight's coming in, and you can see that as the sunlight comes in from different angles, the shadow sort of moves around to track the sunlight. And from the length of the shadows and the known height of the sun, we can that's where we get our estimates of the height of clouds. Now, of course, it's different from a terrestrial hurricane. It's anchored to the pole. It doesn't drift around. It doesn't get its energy in exactly the same way because there's no ocean underneath. Terrestrial hurricane really lives and dies by being over the ocean. And when it moves over land, it quickly shuts down. And it's picking up moisture from the ocean, and then when the moisture condenses, that releases energy, latent heat. And, well, there's no ocean on Saturn, so it's got to be a somewhat different mechanism. But the deep atmosphere does have water, vapor, and other things like ammonia, which can condense and release their latent heat. And so we are pursuing the similarities and differences between these structures on Saturn and the structures we are familiar with on Earth. But we got a ways to go, and we want to see how the this hurricane-like feature changes with seasons, among other things. It is like a southern hemisphere hurricane on Earth. The winds around the eye are very intense, and they go around in a clockwise direction. Hurricanes in the northern hemisphere go around in the winds go around in a counterclockwise direction, but in the southern hemisphere it's clockwise, and that's what the winds do in these Saturn structure. Big differences are no ocean, and the thing is locked to the pole. And the eye is much bigger in size. This shows some of the temperatures. The next slide, very colorful slide with four panels. And the one you should look at is the right panel, the right pair of panels. There's a pressure scale on the left of the left panel, millibars. So 1,000 millibars is the sea level pressure on Earth. And 100 millibars is the pressure at 18 kilometers, or no. Higher than that. Yeah, it maybe is about 18 kilometers on Earth. So, and you can see the colors are temperatures, and so you can see that, and the lower scale is latitude. So 90 degrees, minus 90 is the South Pole. Minus 85 is about 5,000 kilometers away from the South Pole. And there's two dash lines, vertical dash lines. The inner one is the inner eye wall of clouds, and the outer dash line at 88 degrees is the outer eye wall. And you can see that the eye itself is warm, colored red, meaning warm. And there are using some numbers in Celsius, so it's 4 degrees warmer than the area to the equatorward side. And so in that sense, it's like a hurricane. It's got a warm eye with high clouds surrounding it. And it's got clockwise in the southern hemisphere circulation, which is, again, similar to a terrestrial hurricane. All right. Talk about something else. This also has analogies with the Earth. So this is a picture. It's two red planets, one on the left, one on the right, in a black background. One is September 1997 and May 2006, and this is Earth-based images, and these are measurements of temperature, and you can see that the geometry changed. So the equator was sort of at a different place in the image in 97 than it was in 2006. But what you should see, it's a little hard to see in this figure, is that 13 degrees south latitude was a warm place in September 97, and it became a cold place in May 2006. And so what's happening is that there's some sort of oscillation in temperature going on. just south of the equator. And the next slide shows this oscillation in temperatures. This is, again, Earth-based data showing an oscillation in temperature, beautiful sine waves even. And that resembles something, an oscillation that goes on Earth. It's called the quasi-biennial oscillation. It has a period of a little more than 2 years. It's called the QBO for short. On Saturn, it seems to be a 15-year oscillation. And it sort of resembles this temperature oscillation on Earth. Well, where does Cassini fit in? Accompanying the oscillation, the QBO oscillation in temperature on Earth, there is an oscillation in the wind. The stratospheric winds reverse themselves every 2-point-something years on Earth. They blow east for 1 year, and then they blow west the next year, and then they blow east again. And so Cassini was able to verify that this same reversal of wind was happening on Saturn. And so now on Earth, what you get is a stacked pattern of eastward winds at one altitude, and then westward winds below it, and then eastward winds below that. And this whole pattern reverses itself every 2 years, or it reverses itself every year. And so Cassini showed that the same thing happens on Saturn. I'm now looking at a slide that's mostly green, but it's got two blue blobs and one red blob. And those are the reversal of the winds. The red blob is eastward wind, and the blue blobs are westward winds. And there's substantial reversals, or oscillations, let's call them, minus 100, plus 75, minus 50 meters per second. So we found something that's not totally well understood on Earth. We found it on another planet, and we've measured its period. We've verified some of its properties, and this is going to help us understand this kind of phenomenon in general, in a more general context. Let's move on here. The composition of Saturn's atmosphere contains some of the most abundant elements in the periodic table: hydrogen, helium, carbon. Now, the carbon is not in the form of carbon, it's in the form of methane, CH4. Because there's so much hydrogen that any carbon just reacts with the hydrogen to form methane. But there's oxygen in the form of water, because any oxygen around reacts with the hydrogen to form H2O. And there's nitrogen in the form of ammonia, which is NH3. And there's phosphorus, which is pH3. Any loose atoms that are capable of reacting with hydrogen are going to do so. And that's not all. Those are the sort of equilibrium components of the atmosphere. But there's active chemistry going on, driven mostly by sunlight, but also by electrically charged particles striking the atmosphere, basically the auroras. And so you get stuff like acetylene, which is C2H2, and ethane, which is C2H6. And we're trying to sort out this chemistry. I'm not going to go into all the subtleties of it. It's a kind of simple organic chemistry involving hydrocarbons. And it's interesting not only for its own sake, but it's also interesting because we can work out the circulation of the atmosphere. now they've stopped exploding. So we can use some of these chemical components like acetylene and ethane as traces of the circulation. Acetylene gets destroyed and reformulated rather quickly, whereas ethane takes a long time, and it's just like having embedded clocks in your wind, and you can learn a lot about how fast the wind is blowing in some of these things. You can learn about the upper atmosphere. This is way up, where gases are very thin, and this is I'm looking at a plot that has three colored curves on it, blue, red, and sort of brownish red. And this shows the temperatures in the high upper atmosphere getting up to 300 Kelvin, 400 Kelvin, 450 Kelvin. And something of a mystery here. Why should, with the sun beating down in the southern hemisphere, why should the southern hemisphere be colder? That's the 42.7. Than the equator, where it's just actually getting less sunlight. Remember, it's summer in the south right now. So we're trying to sort that out. Don't fully understand it. But we want to watch the temperatures change of the upper atmosphere, or change with seasons. We don't know the answer to why the temperatures behave the way they do. Next slide shows some of these many gases in the atmosphere, a bunch of green curves. Last topic is lightning. So now I'm looking at a slide that is black in the upper right portion and then shows some clouds in the lower left portion. We can't see the lightning on Saturn, but we can hear it in a special way. The reason we can't see it is that the dark side of Saturn is not very dark. Or another way to say it is the night side, when the sun isn't shining, is still getting illuminated by light from the ring. So you can imagine if the full moon on Earth covered most of the sky at night. And that's what the rings of Saturn do. If you were floating around in a balloon on the night side of Saturn and you looked up, you'd see just nothing but ring shine. And you could, it would be much brighter than the full moon on Earth. You could read a book. You can read a book in the full moon of Earth, but you can really read a book with sunglasses on the night side of Saturn. Well, that's a problem if you're trying to measure faint lightning flashes coming up from deep clouds that are hidden by upper clouds, because you need it to be dark to see those lightning flashes, and it's not very dark. So we can't really, so far, we haven't been able to see the lightning flashes directly with visible light. But the lightning flashes give off, just as they do on Earth, they give off radio noise with a very characteristic sharp, bursty kind of property. And the Cassini spacecraft detects the radio noise of the lightning on Saturn. Trouble is, the lightning storms, the radio noise they detect, it's a very sort of intermittent character. Months will go by and Cassini, or even sometimes years will go by, and Cassini will not detect any radio emission from Saturn. And then all of a sudden, within a space of a day, the radio noise will start up. And so this has become sort of a game we play. the radio, the people in charge of the radio wave instrument, call up the people in charge of the camera and say, are you looking at Saturn today? And we usually say, no, we have a sequence to observe the rings or the icy satellites. But sometimes we say yes. And they say, well, has a new storm popped up in the atmosphere? And we say, well, come to think of it, yesterday, yes, a big new storm just started up in the atmosphere. And it's always like this, that whenever the radio emissions turn on, there'll be a big new storm in the atmosphere. Usually, however, when the camera of Cassini is not looking at Cassini, the next group we call up are the amateur astronomers who can monitor Saturn from Earth. And they are very good to help out and have been very helpful. And they say, yes, there's a new storm on Saturn. And they start taking their photographs from their backyard observatories. And so it's been a great cooperation between the Cassini scientists and the amateur astronomers. And this just shows one of those storms that popped up at one point. It's even better than that because as the planet rotates, the lightning storm passes around on the opposite side, and Cassini can't receive the radio emissions when the storm's around on the opposite side. And then Saturn rotates with about a 10-hour period, so 5 hours later, the storm is on the side facing Cassini, and Cassini detects the radio emissions again. And 5 hours later, it goes behind it. And so we can match it up, and it's obviously the same storm. This is an example. The next slide shows two pictures of Saturn and its rings. And if you look very closely at the upper one, you can see the storm. The upper figure has a little storm in the middle, and the lower figure does not. And so the lower figure is the opposite side of Saturn, 5 hours different from less than 5 hours different from the first one, and the storm is rotated out of view. It's that subtle, but the lightning storms are unique nonetheless, even though it's subtle. Moving on to the next slide shows a plot of the day of year from 2004 to 2006, and the black lines in the upper panel show where the electrostatic discharges were observed. That's the radio noise, the static from the lightning strikes. And you can see that there was a lot of activity in year 2004, and then not much, and then a lot of activity in year 2006. Maybe a little in between, but not much. Finally, we were watching the aurora. Two different images. UVIS is the ultraviolet spectrometer, which measures the aurora on Saturn. There's the auroral oval. The North Pole is right in the center. And then the aurora gives off infrared light, so the VIMS instrument, which measures infrared light, measures the aurora. That's this blue blobby stuff is the aurora, and then underneath that they put a picture of the hexagon. And whether there's a connection between the aurora, which is an upper atmosphere phenomenon, and the hexagon, which is down somewhere in the clouds, that would be a surprise to everyone, but kind of suggestive. I think I'd better stop there. I don't want to bore you with the tables at the end, which show just sort of a summary of the objectives and the questions that you might want to learn about giant planets. I think I've covered them in a more interesting way than some table meant for NASA administrators. So, any questions? Any further questions?
Yes, this is Robert from Salt Lake. I had a question. Now that the rings are sort of edge-on, is there any chance you might be able to detect lightning flashes on the dark side of Saturn?
Absolutely, because the rings when they're totally heads on, they're not capturing any sunlight, and so the dark side of the night side finally gets dark. And we have some a whole set of images planned for the week or two around equinox. So we're hoping that that we'll see the lightning flashes then.
Thank you.
Are there any questions? Any other questions?
Yes, this is Kevin from Wisconsin. On the lightning flashes, are you going to be able to tell how deep they are in the clouds or in the atmosphere?
We did that for Jupiter. We were able to sort of crudely estimate the depth of the clouds, because if you have a flash that's very deep, those photons are going to diffuse out. They'll spread out as they bounce around, scatter off the intervening clouds, and then when they emerge from the top of the clouds, they've all spread out. And the deeper the lightning flash is, the more the photons spread out, and the bigger the lightning flash looks when it finally emerges. The lightning flash itself is not very big, but deep lightning flashes covers more area. And from that, we learned that the lightning flashes were not near the tops of the clouds. They were 100 kilometers down, where we think water clouds are, and in fact, where the temperatures are warm enough for the water clouds to be precipitating rain. And we figured all that out for Jupiter, and we would love to do the same for Saturn. Except that there's a problem. Saturn, the water clouds are 200 kilometers down, and that makes the light more diffuse when it finally emerges from the cloud top.
Yeah, thanks.
Any other questions for our speaker? All right, Dr. Ingersoll, thank you very much. That was really wonderful and well put together and interesting.
Well, it was my pleasure, and hope to...
And happy anniversary.
Another time next year.
I'd like to know if our next speaker is online. Dr. Alexander, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Wonderful. Dr. Claudia Alexander is a staff scientist on the Cassini Project. She has a background in magnetospheric physics, and she is also the project scientist for Rosetta.
That's correct.
Very well. The presentation she'll be giving is available online as a PDF. And Dr. Alexander, please go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to sort of summarize in meticulous detail what we've learned in the five years since we started these CHARM programs, because actually I think I did that a few months ago. I sort of went through, just as Andy just did with his, as we were getting ready to talk about trying to get an extended mission, we did have in the top of our minds, you know, where were we at the beginning and where are we now, and we went through in really meticulous detail, and I think that presentation is available. I thought I would do something a little bit different, and so let's go to page two. Believe it or not, it in honor of Michael Jackson, I have a song of his that I really like and always think of when I listen to it. I think of the magnetosphere. And believe it or not, I put this together before the unfortunate events of last week. And in the process of getting all the material assembled for the talk, we had to investigate our copyright, because I was going to try to play the chorus, and we don't have copyright permission to play that chorus, but we do have permission to just read the words, and so I'm going to do this. This is the theme song for this presentation, which is 2,000 Watts, which is off of Michael Jackson's Invincible album, the last album that he made. And the chorus goes something like this, 2,000 Watts, 8 ohms, 200 volts, real strong, and that's as much of the chorus as I'm going to do. But we're going to think about that as we go through this presentation, and I may read the words again. In terms of what we learn and why we study the magnetosphere. Almost all of the planets have a magnetosphere. If you have metallic material or something that is capable of conducting currents in the core of a planet or even outside the core of a planet, you are very likely to be able to generate a magnetic field if the currents are in motion. And when we first begin thinking about these magnetic fields, we think normally of a typical dipole, which on page 3 is shown on the leftmost graphic. The little red line is kind of the orange peel structure of how we sort of think about a theoretical, idealized magnetic field of a planet. And when you plunk that in the middle of the solar wind, and I'll talk about that in a minute, it forms a lovely magnetosphere. It's like a water balloon or a bubble in the middle of the streaming solar wind, and has effects on the one on the Earth, protects us from solar particles and from cosmic rays and the like. And so I believe that the more we will be venturing into space, the more concerned we will be as the decades go by with the structure of the magnetic field and the sun's magnetic field, and we will be more cognizant of these electromagnetic structures in space in which we are embedded. So when we got to Saturn, one of the first things that we wanted to do in terms of understanding the magnetosphere was to understand the global morphology of it, the size and the shape and so forth. And so the figures on the right is our attempt to understand what this thing looks like. It's, of course, invisible, so we have to use instruments that are capable of detecting electric and magnetic fields and the particles that respond to them. And in the course of the 5 years that we've been there, we have learned something sort of astonishing about Saturn's magnetic field, which is that rather than having this sort of straightforward dipolar shape, the orange peel shape that I talked about on the left, it's got this very odd salad bowl shape, and it's tilted. So it's even though the magnetic field and the magnetic axis and the rotational axis of Saturn are practically aligned, one of the only planets in the solar system that has that kind of configuration, even so, the magnetosphere has a tilt to it, as you see. And that leads to some strange, interesting phenomena. I'm going to go on now to page 4. And then this page, what we have is, in my view, a beautiful illustration of the scale of a magnetosphere of a giant planet compared to something that we have at the Earth. So this is actually Jupiter and the Earth, but Saturn is a giant planet like Jupiter, so the scale of Saturn's magnetosphere isn't as big as that of Jupiter, but it's more Jupiter-like than it is like the Earth. And this drawing is not even to the correct scale, but it does give you the flavor of the size of the structure relative at Jupiter relative to that at the Earth. At Jupiter, the magnetic field is so large that the sun itself could fit inside. And the magneto tail of the magnetosphere of Jupiter stretches off to the orbit of Saturn. And again, if we sing that song, 2,000 watts, the giant yellow donut-shaped object in the middle of the Jupiter magnetosphere in this drawing is the current disk. It contains a tremendous amount of power as it grows around Jupiter, and much more power than we have at the Earth. And Saturn, as I said, is expected to be much more Jupiter-like. So that is among the things that we wanted to measure. Going on to page 5, I mentioned that the magnetosphere of the planet is plunked right into the middle of the solar wind. Now, you may or may not know, President George Bush evidently was not aware that space is not empty. It's filled with the solar wind and the sun's magnetic field, which we call the interplanetary magnetic field, or the IMF. And those two things pressing on a magnetosphere give us what we call space weather. And they very much influence how the planet responds to the sun and how those particles get embedded in the magnetosphere and rain down on the poles, creating aurora and other things that we have to be alert to, especially if we send astronauts up into space on the space shuttle, for example, even. We have to be alert for the space weather environment. So on this page, what we have is red, amber, and green, meaning the active, disturbed, and quiet times of the sun. And there are observatories that are constantly watching the sun now, measuring and calculating the solar wind pressure that's going to press on the nose of the magnetosphere of Earth. And that is measured in terms of X-rays, radio waves, and other solar particles that are constantly streaming out from the sun. They measure the density and so forth of some of these things, and they tell us whether you have active conditions, disturbed, or quiet conditions. And on the next page, which on this one, the sun is to the right. On some of the other diagrams that I've shown you, the sun is to the left. But in this diagram, the solar wind is blowing past the magnetosphere of Saturn, and in this salad bowl-shaped magnetosphere, which is tilted up, with the front part being sort of blown back, we have, you know, what we think, as we have flown around the magnetosphere for 5 years, we're beginning to map out the shape of this intangible object. It is, kind of more blunt on the day side, where the solar wind is pressing against it, and it is more extended in a sort of teardrop shape in the back. And all the moons go around inside, with the exception of Titan, which is actually sometimes in the solar wind. It's sometimes it's far enough out from Saturn, and it can rotate into this magnetosheath, which is considered part of the solar wind of Saturn. So we, after 5 years, it's almost like the blind men and the elephants. You know, we've gone around feeling our way around, trying to create a map of what this environment looks like. Now, on the next diagram, we have a somewhat different view. Again, this is, feeling our way around the elephant. In the sort of green line, we have the magnetic field line, which is sort of kind of what that is meant by the orange teal shape, the dipole field line. This is the updated and more realistic shape of the field line in green, with the blunter shape on the day side. And here, the sun is to the left, and the solar wind is blowing past from the left to the right. And the tail is stretched out in the back. And what we see are more structures that we, as a field and particle instruments, kind of trying to sense and build a map for ourselves of what is there. And what we have in this orange and red sort of donut-shaped thing around Saturn is what we call a partial ring current. And again, I'm going to sing the theme song again, 2,000 watts, because that's where the power in the magnetosphere is carried in some of those currents. We can compare the ring current of Saturn with the giant plasma disk and ring current of Jupiter, and we can also compare it to the more modest temporal, I don't want to say, I'm looking for a word besides temporal, which, well, I'll think of the word in a minute, but anyway, kind of lightweight ring current that we have at the Earth. And then in the back, stretched out, is another green shape, which is actually in the plane, in the equatorial plane. And these are, you know, more plasma clouds that are, in some cases, being ejected into the back down the tail of Saturn. And I'm going to talk about that in a moment as well. So let's go to the next slide. Now, I won't sing the song again, but let's talk about power in the magnetosphere. At Earth, a typical geomagnetic substorm in which the solar wind gets into the Earth's magnetosphere and begins to drive plasma, and the plasma gets dumped into the aurora zone, the power in that process is estimated to be about 150 gigawatts of power. And just for comparison, I happen to make notes whenever I see calculations like this. And one time we had a power blackout in Los Angeles, where I live, and the Los Angeles Times reported that the municipal burden of the city of Los Angeles, which is all the city buildings, the amount of power that it takes to run the city buildings is 280 megawatts. So, doing a back-of-the-envelope calculation, that suggests to me that a terrestrial substorm is roughly the equivalent of 1,000 large cities. And I have a call coming through on my cell phone, so let me just do something here for a minute to tell this guy to get off the phone. That's the problem with a cell phone. Anyway, so, and then I noticed I'm in London. Wimbledon is taking place right now, and the London papers were talking about how in last year's fantastic final, evidently people were watching TV, and when the final was over, there was a huge electrical spike, where everybody turned on their lights at the same time, and that was equivalent to 1,400 megawatts, which they said was equivalent to 500,000 tea kettles being set to boiling at once. So, so a typical on Earth, the power that is being generated in the magnetosphere is on the order of 1,000 times more than what we see in our cities. At Saturn, the estimated power in the Coronian or the Saturnian ring current is multiple tens of terawatts. So that's about a billion cities the size of Los Angeles, and I don't think there are a million cities the size of Los Angeles on Earth. So that's a huge amount of power, and just to give you a feeling for how much power is in this invisible structure. How does the solar wind, I'm going on to the next page, affect storms that take place in the magnetosphere? We know that at Earth, the solar wind will press on the day side of the magnetosphere and cause this sort of water balloon to change its shape and to cause certain of it to lose mass down the tail. And so when the solar wind blows stronger, the day side magnetosphere compresses, and the increased angular momentum leads to increased azimuthal flow of cold plasma on the day side, and that incurs a stronger centrifugal force acting on the cold plasma. And so it's free to expand into the night side, and so you have the release of plasma down the tail in this process. And this is a process that we expect to happen, but proving that this is really the right physics that's happening in this environment is something that we're still trying to sense and detect all of the different structures that will tell us that this is the right physics. And if we, again, going to page 10, if we go to the example of the Earth, we have our sort of orange peel-shaped magnetosphere with the magnetic field lines on the day side of this diagram, where the sun, the solar wind, is blowing against the Earth from the left to the right. And the Earth's magnetic tail is stretched out into the back, and the magnetic field lines form this red X, and so that's called an X line in this model of how the sun drives the plasma inside of the Earth's magnetosphere. And so the X line is about between somewhere around 50 RE, or the radius of the Earth downstream. And just as a note, the Earth's moon is at about 60 RE. And we've said before that the stronger the sun wind blows, the more that water balloon of the magnetosphere changes its shape. And so sometimes it gets stretched out, the Earth's magnetic field gets stretched out into that X, and then it rebounds. It's like a rubber band. It gets stretched out, and then it snaps back. So here's this idiot calling me again on my cell phone. So I'm going to try to multitask and tell him to leave me alone while I continue to try to address the next page. So one of the questions that we want to ask is, does Saturn have a magnetotail? This was when we set out at the beginning of the mission 5 years ago. We're trying to map out this structure, and we're very, you know, magnetotail has certain dynamics. And if we just had, you know, the sort of orange peel shape of the dipole, and then a sort of a stretched out and a cavity in the back of the planet, that would not really be the kind of magnetotail that we are thinking of, like with the Earth and with Jupiter. A magnetotail has a current in the middle, that Earth. That Dungey-style circulation that I just talked about with that X line is formed with the interaction with the solar wind. At Jupiter, the planet doesn't really interact very much with the sun. It's not coupled very strongly to the sun. And so it's the internal planetary wind itself that causes the formation of these structures that we're looking for. So we're trying to figure out, is Saturn like the Earth, more like the Earth, and driven, the internal dynamics of the magnetosphere driven by the sun? Or is it more like Jupiter, where we have this the planet's plasma coming from the moon Io and is driving the planetary, the dynamics inside the magnetosphere of Jupiter? And being able to find these X lines and sensing when that rubber band snaps back and the X line passes back across the spacecraft is one of the things that we would be looking for. And that event would be called a dipolarization. And in 5 years, we have detected three of them. So it indicates that some sort of Dungey style is at work at Saturn. And it tells us that there's a magnetotail present, and it's behaving a lot like either the Earth or Jupiter, but we sure have a lot more work to do to figure out how the dynamics work. And part of it is that we haven't gotten into that region at Saturn that would correspond to where that X line is located. And so we're hoping that to do that in the extended mission if it gets approved. So, as I was preparing for this talk, I came across a book called 50 Things You Should Know About Physics. And it's in all the bookstores around. We're visiting London, conducting one of our big meetings where we talk about the science of the mission. So I thought, oh, well, 50 Things You Should Know, okay. That everybody should know. And one of the things I noticed was that they talk about Ohm's law. They talk about electricity charge can pile up, creating static electricity, or charge can flow, creating a current. And in the magnetosphere, we're very interested in these currents. And if we go back to that song by Michael Jackson, 2,000 watts, 8 ohms, so there's those ohms, right? The ohms, even if you're a musician or an electrical engineer in a music studio, you know about current, you know about watts, ohms, and volts. An ohm is a measurement of current, and a current comes from material moving in an electric field or blobs of material moving against a magnetic field. And so if we go to the next page, one of the things that we are constantly measuring in order to try to build up our understanding of where are the currents and how are the currents moving the plasma in the magnetosphere, where is the energy being deposited and where is the momentum being deposited, we are measuring current and measuring the movement of plasma. And so this slide here talks about the radial movement of plasma in the magnetosphere. This is a little bit, it's turned 90 degrees from the diagrams that we've looked at leading up to this, the previous ones, which were kind of left to right. And in this one, the ionosphere or the atmosphere of Saturn is at the top, and the magnetosphere is at the bottom, and there's a sort of bubble in this stick figure that is moving inward, a bubble of plasma moving inward. And as it does so, there are currents that are going both along the around the planet in the equatorial plane, and they're creating pressure that's moving the bubble towards the planet. And that is creating current that's also connected into the ionosphere and then coming back out. And so the movement of plasma like this can sometimes be captured in the aurora. In other words, the currents that go from bubbles of plasma and connect into the ionosphere of the planet can sometimes light up the ionosphere. They dump enough energy to cause the molecules that are in the atmosphere that respond to that much power to fluoresce. And you see that sometimes being a reflection of what's happening downstream, way, way, way down, maybe 20 to 30 planetary radius down into the magnetosphere. So these are among the things that we are looking for and measuring and still trying to understand. If we go to the next page, Andy talked about the hexagon and the aurora, which is one of our most favorite pictures. We don't understand the physics and or if there's any connection between the aurora and the hexagon. Andy talked about it being highly unlikely. And all I'll say is that among the things that we are still trying to understand, we know Saturn has aurora. In the bottom figure here on this page, we are showing some of the currents. We have the red there is the plasma in the disk. And the currents in the white going from the disk and connecting into the ionosphere and back again. These are all part of the things that we explore with the instruments, the magnetospheric instruments. So I'm just going to go over a summary of our discoveries. Saturn's magnetosphere is very tilted, which was a surprise because the rotational axis and the magnetic axis were almost nearly aligned for this planet. The solar wind influence turns out to be relatively mild. It seems that the magnetosphere responds more to internal forces at Saturn than to the Sun. The magnetosphere is filled with neutrals, and the influence of the neutral cloud at Saturn's magnetosphere is great. The work in progress that we have is understanding the roles of currents in moving plasma around the magnetosphere, understanding the aurora, and understanding the magnetotail dynamics, the role of that Dungey cycle. What we intend to do more in the coming, what we're doing now and in the extended mission if it gets approved, we didn't reach the magnetotail reconnection region, and so we would like to study that portion of the magnetosphere of Saturn. We need to do in-place observations to try to understand the currents and beams that move between the plasma sheet and the auroral zone. We want to look for temporal time variations in some of the phenomena. And we need to look at, in space, as many latitudes and longitudes and close up to try to continue to map the structure of the magnetosphere, especially very close in the 3 to 5 radii of Saturn region. And as Andy talked about, we still don't really know the internal rotation period. It's migrated. We know it, but it's migrated around and it's off by about as much as 10 minutes. So those are some of the things that we will be continuing to work on as we continue to explore Saturn's environment for the next several years. Next is an appendix for some of the terms that are related to the magnetosphere. I always try to include that in case I mentioned anything that, and you'd like to know a little bit more about what that means. So that's it.
Thank you, Dr. Alexander. Does anyone have any questions? I guess you did such a comprehensive job. All right. I'd like to thank everybody very much for phoning in. I'd like to thank our two speakers for their time and their wonderfully clear presentations. A reminder that the second part of this anniversary charm presentation will be taking place in Tuesday. That will be July 28th, the last Tuesday of the month, as are all charm presentations. Thank you very much. We will see you next month.
Thank you. Is that you, Joe?
Yes.
So was anybody online?
Yes, there were people online.
Okay, good.
Yes. There were.
Not like I'm talking to a big vacuum.
No.
So, okay, well, I guess
it's
I'm going to take
really
off, too.
It.
Oh, good. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye.
Okay, Joe, I'm going to take off.